moment you've been waiting for, which is to know what the question is, to which you, of course, can answer with one voice. And the question I think that we've been discussing is that the original concern that came to us was not actually one over initial recognition, but it was over subsequent measurement, remeasurement of the liabilities. And the staff advised me that the best place to start would be just getting everybody's agreement on the initial recognition, and then it would make it simpler and more logical for us to answer the remeasurement question. Well, that didn't happen. But the good news is we did agree about what to do with the credit. So what we're going to do is move on to the next paper to consider the remeasurement of the credit and see how close we can get there to circle back and loop around. My concern here is that there is an issue that has arisen that's causing significant divergence in practice at the moment. The board's project, Financial Instruments with the Characteristics of Equity, is one that has a lesser priority in terms of its June 2011 timetable. And so that is a project that is going at a slower rate. It hasn't been deferred, it hasn't been abandoned, it's going at a slower rate than it was originally planned. And so we can't piggyback on that as seemed to be the case at the May meeting. So if we are going to find a resolution to please our constituents in the short term, we've almost got to go it alone. That restricts our options because it doesn't give us the same opportunity to make substantial changes to the literature. So I think we're stuck with what's in 32 at the moment, just as we are with what's in 27 at the moment and the conflicts between them. So, David, could I ask you now to not completely forget about paper 4B, because we will hopefully return to it one day, but to turn to paper 4C, which seems to be the least controversial of all the discussions this afternoon.
We will see. I say, a lot of discussion around whether people agreed with everything in the agenda paper so far, but I would just point out paragraph 24 of agenda paper 4A, and I quote, "The staff think the committee may find it challenging to reach a consensus on initial recognition." So, anyway.
Staff is very conceptive.
Okay, so let's take a look at agenda paper 4C. This is addressing really the key question that came into the committee that we discussed in the May meeting. The agenda paper we presented in May had a pretty detailed sort of technical and also sort of conceptual analysis on this issue. So we've summarised those somewhat, I would say, in agenda paper 4C to avoid just repeating everything that we discussed back in May. But broadly, the paper summarises the two key views here that are emerging. The first is the profit or loss view. We'll explain that, I think, in paragraph 16 onwards of the paper. And this really follows the financial instruments literature and would say that because we're recognising a financial liability on initial recognition of the puts, or put another way, if we've got a financial liability relating to the NCI puts, the changes in that financial liability would be reflected in profit or loss in accordance with IAS 39. The contrasting view here, which begins in paragraph 23 of this paper, would be an equity view, and this view would propose that changes in the carrying amount of a financial liability recognised in relation to an NCI put would be recognised in equity. The view proposing this equity approach really looks up primarily, I would say, to the guidance in IAS 27 relating to transactions with owners in their capacity as owners. And secondly, there's also maybe some analogies to be made to some of the guidance in IFRIC 17. the technical arguments really, I think, consider, if we're thinking about the equity view, are considering the changes in the financial liability, which may include accretion amounts, other measurement adjustments, in some ways to be equivalent to a change in the parent's ownership of the shares subject to the put. In other words, really relating to the non-controlling interest component here. When they look at the sort of profit and loss view, I think they'd say, well, you know, is this really consistent with how we think about an exercise of the put? We've already talked a bit about the FICE project particularly and concerns around really whether it leads to good financial reporting. Does it lead to intuitive answers here? With that, I think in paragraph 58 of the paper, we've got the staff recommendation. When we've looked at this in terms of current IFRSs, I think we've really taken the view that if we've got a financial liability, the current guidance in IAS 39 would indicate that changes in that financial liability should be recognised in profit and loss. And so I think on interpreting the current literature, the staff would support the profit or loss view.
Okay, thanks, David. Any comments from members? Does anybody object to the staff recommendation? Ben?
I'm not objecting. I just have a question for my understanding. Is it possible that I, with this approach, that I have the same revenue twice in P&L? First, when I consolidate the subsidiary, and then by revaluing the liability, or is that not possible? Because I don't have NCI anymore.
Okay, so we've got to be careful whether we've still got NCI or not based on our initial recognition conclusion.
It's an answer that we can't give you without some further reflection, unless other members would like to volunteer a guess. Intuitively, you shouldn't be recognizing the income or the revenue twice, but if you consolidate the subsidiary, then the question is, if you're measuring the liability to take into account the changes in the accretion of the equity portion of it, then they're reflected in the measurement change of the liability, then changes in that liability would also be reflected in profit and loss. Jean-Louis?
No, I definitely support the equity approach. I think that if we reflect in the P&L the variation of the liability, you treat the liability as differently as you would do with the third party. Because if we were doing the exercise of the third party, and for example, if you have a put at fair value, from the beginning, the value, the fair value of the liability will be nil. Then, the more your subsidiary is performing, you will have an additional price for the NCI for the put option. So, it will create an expense in your P&L, which, in my view, on an economic point of view, makes no sense. So I think the only way, and then it retracts to the discussion we had before on the nature of the original entry, would be equity.
Peter?
I will only very generally refer to 4B. Because I can definitely see the arguments in IAS 39 to show all the changes of the liabilities through P&L. But I'm interested in the view of the staff to some other arguments that also have been listed in this paper, and that's where I'm referring back to the discussion we had before. There's something here in the paper for the equity view that looks at paragraph 31 and 27, which deals with how do you recognize the consideration, the fair value of consideration paid for this acquired or sold non-controlling interest. And it says you have to show that in equity. Now, fair value of consideration might also include contingent considerations. If our view is that we don't want to double account and that's why we de-recognize non-controlling interests, then I think that brings some more weight on this argument by saying, well, if I de-recognize non-controlling interests and there is a change in what I have to pay for that, that seems to be something like contingent consideration, and I don't have any rules for how to account for that as compared to IFRS 3 business combinations. If I look into 31 of 27, actually I think it tells us you have to show that as equity, as part of the equity transaction. So I see a little bit of a problem here, that 39 tells us show the changes in the liability for P&L, but 27 tells us, at least you could see it that way, that the contingent consideration should be recognized in equity. And that's the main problem that I have with the view it goes through P&L. I can see probably more arguments in favor of P&L, but we also have this guidance in 27, and we're struggling with us saying, well, that doesn't matter. 39 is the better approach, and we don't look at what is in paragraph 31 of IAS 27. So I was asking myself whether the staff has some arguments against this equity transaction accounting via contingent consideration. And there's one other issue that I feel in my paper, but I don't think that it's a convincing argument. But if you look into 23 of IAS 32, they only refer to the subsequent measurement. So you should measure subsequently the liability by looking into 39. And the green book that we don't have here then only refers to paragraph 47 in 39, which tells you how to measure. But how to recognize the gains and losses is in paragraph 55. That's not a convincing argument to me. What is really convincing to me, or seems to be an issue here, is this equity transaction issue in paragraph 31 of 27.
I'm not sure now if you're somebody who supports the equity view or not, or are you just undecided at this stage?
I have to say I have some sympathy for showing it through P&L. I can see the arguments, but I'm struggling to wipe out this other argument that others have. So maybe at the end of the day, maybe the staff can convince me that 31, that I've read 31 wrongly. If not, then I see myself in a position where there is something in 39 that seems to contradict 27, and I'm struggling to make a decision here. I think we would then have to put it through the annual improvement project to change this contradiction within standards.
Michael, everybody wants to go to annual improvements, and I never think that they are. If there's a conflict between two standards, and they've both been written deliberately to get a particular outcome, and they conflict, now I think it's an IFRIC responsibility to resolve that conflict, as we had to do in IFRIC 10 many years ago, or alternatively to refer it back to the board to fix it up in one of the board projects, which obviously wouldn't be expeditious. To the annual improvements, really, the classification is it's a minor amendment, and that is, we wouldn't expect that too many people would object, even if there is a change in practice. And I think, judging by the reaction around this room and the inability to agree on paper 4B, that you could hardly say that it's something that is not going to be contentious. So let's keep going anyway. Scott?
On this one, I thought the answer was clear, and the staff had it right. It has to go through P&L. I can't see any justification for treating the changes in the liability for an NCI put any different from the changes in the liability for a put on parent company equity. It's all changes in the value of a put on equity. I see nothing in the literature that allows me to treat changes in the value of NCI equity differently, or changes in the value of a put on NCI equity different from changes in the value of a put on parent equity. And I believe parent changes in the value of a parent equity put, we would run through P&L. If we write a fair value put on parent company equity, that would change, and the changes would go through P&L. I think we have to do the same for NCI equity. And I think we have to do that because we have to accept the board's conclusion that non-controlling interest is equity and not something other than equity. And therefore, I think we need to treat changes in the value the same. I think the argument for the equity view of this is, and I can't believe I'm even bringing this up, but it is the SEC's accounting series release 268 and the EITF issue D98, which is that the issue of how the putable equity is shown is a display issue only and not a recognition issue. And ASR 268 and D98 are there because in U.S. GAAP, we don't show the gross amount of the liability. And so what the SEC said a long time ago is that when you have putable equity, the redemption amount needs to be shown as temporary equity, something between liability and equity, the mezzanine it's often referred to. And the way that is handled is you do your normal accounting for the equity as if it wasn't putable, and then when it comes time to present the financial statements, to prepare the financial statements, you take the amount that is redeemable, add its redemption value, whatever that currently is, and you just reclassify that at period end, essentially. You reclassify that into temporary equity. I think the equity view in this paper would be arguing essentially that the liability classification of these puts on both parent and non-controlling interest is simply a display issue. We've elected to display it as a liability rather than equity, but it's equity for all other purposes. But I don't think that's consistent with what the literature says. I think that the IFRS literature, it doesn't say this is equity for all purposes except display. It says this is a liability. And since it says that, I think we've got to do the accounting.
Laurence?
I can understand the P&L answer if you focus on the nature of the instrument, on the nature of the instrument that is, if you consider it a financial instrument. But again, as I said before, if we are in a case where we continue to allocate profit and losses to non-controlling interests, and so the parent does not account for that element, I do believe that we still have that double counting problem that was mentioned before, because as Jean-Louis mentioned it, if you have a profitable subsidiary to which you allocate part of the profit to, you continue to allocate part of the profit to the NCI, so the group doesn't get this part of the profit. And in addition, because the value for fair value puts, the value of the puts will have increased, the liability will have increased, this will represent an expense in P&L against the parent's share. So you don't have the profit to the NCI and you have an expense. And I'm asking, is this accounting make sense? Is this something you can explain to the outside users? Personally, I have problem with this accounting. So I do think that a solution needs to be found to get to some accounting that makes sense.
and that's what we're here for, Laurent. So what is your solution?
I think that Guido was trying, either we solve the issue through the paper we did not conclude on, which was a paper for B about whether attributing all profits, considering that the NCI no longer exists, or we try to solve through an amendment and ask that changes in fair value for those puts, because in substance they are repurchased of non-controlling interest for which we know the accounting treatment under IAS 27, that is, it is equity, that there is a limited amendment to IAS 39 to explain that for those changes they should be recognized in equity. It's very focused, it's very narrow, there is no analogy that can be made.
So, sorry, you're saying then that in the financial instrument standards we must rewrite the sections that say currently that if you've written a put on these shares, instead of accounting for it gross, you should account for it as a separate derivative, but unlike other derivatives, that you should account for changes in that derivative through equity.
I would not go for the treatment as a derivative. I would continue to have the gross liability, but I would just have a treatment that would just say the changes that would go in equity. But this comment is subject to what we are going to conclude on the first paper for the initial recognition, and whether or not NCI are going
to be fair, Laurence, nobody wrote into us and said that they have a problem with the initial recognition, they have a problem with the subsequent measurement.
I have a problem.
We have a problem with deciding how to do the initial recognition. Anyway, it's not 7 o'clock yet, so we'll keep going around. Tack?
I rather prefer equity rather than profit or loss, because basically this is the conflict between single economic entity unit theory and parent theory. And as far as IFRS 3 and IAS 27 is concerned, it is based on the single economic entity theory. And IAS 39 and 32 does not really follow the single economic entity theory. It is not clear. But the conflicting point is regarding the kind of merger accounting or acquisition accounting, which is the area of IFRS 3 and IAS 27 rather than IAS 39 or 32. So in that sense, this matter should be measured through the based on the concept of single economic entity theory rather than parent theory. And another reason is that in paper 4D we discussed dividend, and then staff recommended dividend should be treated as a capital transaction. So if we treat liability measurement in the profit or loss and the dividend in the capital transaction, it is contradictory, not consistent. So therefore, in order to avoid such kind of things, I rather prefer equity.
Ruth?
I support the staff's conclusion that the liability is measured through profit and loss. I think it's unavoidable under IAS 39. I can see the distinction between the NCI put and contingent consideration in this regard, because it does effectively become it's a financial liability under IAS 39. The parent has no choice but to pay when it's told to pay. So to me, it's clearly an IAS 39 financial liability. And I can distinguish it between the IFRIC 17 dividend obligation, where we said that the remeasurement is to do with the distribution to shareholders, and that's why that clearly is a transaction with shareholders and would be an equity transaction. So to me, the remeasurement through P&L is clear as daylight under IAS 39. However, I understand the problem, which is we are taking this double hit, which is we might be taking up our share of profits or losses or whatever of the subsidiary, and at the same time we're remeasuring the liability. And I think the problem can be solved fairly neatly by going through Patricia's suggested solution, which is to recharacterise the equity to liability and not account for both at the same time. And if we do that, then we've got rid of NCI, effectively. We've replaced it with this liability. We only remeasure the liability. We give the parent 100% share of the profit. And that way we avoid the double counting. And to me, if we do that, then we stay true to IAS 39. We avoid the does not make sense argument because we manage to make it make sense. And I think we can solve it quite neatly. Maybe I'm being over-optimistic, but I think we can get there.
I'll try to agree with you on being easy, but just for clarification. Talk about the remeasurement of the liability and the changes. What do you envisage the liability measurement would be? Would it be the measurement of both the redemption amount and the implicit value of the put option? Would it only be the redemption amount? Or would it be some sort of hybrid that takes into account the, what do we call it, allocated amount that it would have been carried out had it been accounted for as equity?
Yeah, I think it might have. I haven't given that enough thought. But I think in order to avoid the does not make sense problem that Laurence and others have referred to, it might have to be some sort of hybrid between the two, but I haven't given it enough thought.
But we're mindful of Scott's concern, yeah, and mine, I must admit, that if you account for it as purely a liability and it's carried at amortized cost,
yeah, yeah, I can see the problem.
Then you're not going to get much of a change other than the unwinding of the discounting factor. Okay, let's keep going. Sarah?
I would tend to agree with the staff's recommendation that the change in the carrying value, fair value of the put liability, which is a financial instrument, should run through the P&L. I'm sympathetic to tax's argument, though. I like the argument of the single entity theory, but I confess I looked at this as it is the parent who wrote the put on the non-controlling interest, so I was looking at the parent's bookkeeping as opposed to the consolidated entity. That may be wrong, but that was how I looked at it. So I'm in the P&L camp, I guess.
So single entity theory, I mean, does underlie 27, and it exists in there, and whether it's the parent entity or it is the entity itself, the consolidated entity, something within there. But the issue is that it's a transaction that is written with currently an equity participant who is an equity participant in a consolidated or controlled subsidiary. So this is consolidated financial reporting that I think we're focusing on here. Actually, I keep forgetting about Andrew. So, Jean?
I also like a simple answer to complex situation. I wonder if the reason why there's so much discomfort is because we're trying to fight the answer that is contained in IFRS. Actually, for me, I believe that, maybe wrongly, but that's what's in IFRS. In IFRS, it says that if you have equity instrument that is putable, it's a liability. That's to begin with. If and that's why now we said, oh well, changing the value of the liability goes to P&L. Yes, it's a liability. And I think if we accept that and we go all along with this view, then it means that once you have made the restatement to a liability, a reclassification to a liability, changes in the value of the liability flows to income. There's no allocation to an equity instrument the way we know it, but there is an allocation to the liability. What is the entitlement to the liability? It's not interest. It's share allocation of profit or whatever. So what you raise as the measurement issue of the liabilities is a genuine question. It's a fine question. I don't know what the answer is, but should probably take into consideration that that characteristic. So I know it's fairly unique, but at least if we go this direction, we say that now it's a liability because it's putable, and then we measure the liability to income. We need to find what's the right measurement of the liability, and that's fairly straightforward. So there's no double counting with that.
Peggy?
I would agree with what's been said before. I think it's, I agree that it's P&L. It's consistent with in purchase accounting for contingent consideration. It's consistent with IFRS 9. It's consistent with IAS 39. So I don't think we have a choice, really, to where to put it.
Andrew?
Well, I agree with the recommendation of the staff. I don't see where you can go other than P&L if you read the various bits of the standards. I think the equity transaction is the granting of the option. And then once that's done, you've got a liability, and there's IAS 39 tells you what to do with that. So I very much support staff's recommendation.
Won't let you off the hook just yet. So if it is a liability, it's an interesting point you made about what is the equity transaction. So if the put is exercised, then the consequence of that is that whatever price has been agreed to acquire the equity instruments, the NCI's holding of the shares in the subsidiaries, that the difference between what the entity pays and what the liability amount was would be accounted for in profit and loss. That would be if the put was exercised. But if the shares were sold at a value which was higher than the amount in the put option, then they would be accounted for, presumably, as an equity transaction.
Sorry, that was several questions. Why?
No, you raised it, Andrew.
If you're measuring the liability at the present value of your redemption amount, then the amount you pay should be the money.
But only if the put is exercised.
Yes.
But if it's one of these puts that's way out of the money, but that the entity now buys the equity instruments themselves, direct, not under the put, but buys them independent of the put, and then they pay fair value for them. So instead of paying, I think, if I remember the figures, instead of paying 70, which was the strike price under the put option, that they pay the fair value, which is 150.
So the entity buys the shares from the... Sorry. Who's got the shares at the moment?
Well, regardless of what our accounting is, there are still non-controlling shareholders who own share instruments in the subsidiary. And they're entitled to sell them regardless of whether they hold a put. The put guarantees them a price at which they can put the shares, but if they get a higher price, then they're also entitled to do that. So I'm just... Maybe I should ask David. He's got nothing else to do at the moment.
But it's just, I think that gets into some of the issues we raise in the lapsing and exercising of these instruments in a paper that we probably will not get to today. And you know, you start thinking through the symmetry there around whether I've got a second equity transaction at that point or whether I've got impacts there that will be recognised in profit or loss.
Yeah. Okay. But I'll take your point that the issue of the put option is itself an equity transaction at that stage. But then you're saying it then gives us a liability. And that's what we want to account for subsequently. Sorry. Scott?
With respect to the single economic entity theory, I think that P&L is consistent with the single economic entity theory because I think with the single economic entity, it means you ought to get the same P&L answer, whether you write a put on parent equity, whether the subsidiary writes a put on subsidiary equity to a non-controlling interest holder, or whether the parent writes a put on subsidiary equity to the non-controlling interest holder. You ought to wind up with the same P&L, and I think you only do that in this case if you go to P&L. With respect to the double counting issue that can arise here, But I think a way to think about this might be to change the allocation between controlling and non-controlling interest of the earnings in the NCI to give credit, as it were, for the fact that some of the allocation to the NCI already happened through P&L, and maybe we don't need to make it through the allocation in the equity statement as well. So if the fair value of the NCI put, assuming we have a put at fair value, so if the fair value of the subsidiary went up and that caused in consolidation a loss of 100 to be recognized in P&L related to the redemption amount of the NCI, then when we go to allocate the earnings of the NCI, the first 100 that would have gone to the non-controlling interest will go to the parent to recognize the fact that essentially that allocation was already recognized through P&L. Now, quite frankly, I think that's just a rule. I'm not sure I can define the principle. But, I mean, I think that the reason why we're facing this issue is because we have bad measurement of the put. And where we have a principle that's driving some what we think of as poor accounting, you know, if we can just create a rule that makes the accounting less poor, maybe that's better than any of the alternatives, because I'm loath to change whether we recognize the P&L movement on the liability, and I'm loath to measure the liability, as some have suggested, at perhaps more than the exercise price. You know, take care of my earlier concern, we don't want to limit the measurement of the NCI to the 1 euro exercise price that we know will never happen. So some have said, we still got to reclassify it to a liability, but maybe we'll measure it at a greater amount. Well, I think that overstates the liability if we do that. The entity cannot be forced to pay more than that 1 euro in cash, so I'd rather not recognize a liability of more than the 1 euro. I got to recognize the 1 euro liability. But maybe I fix this for the fair value puts in substance by giving credit in the allocation of the earnings of the subsidiary.
It's a little bit like that.
Sarah?
I think at this point I'll simply say it's got to be P&L. As far as I'm concerned, it's unavoidable if it's a financial liability, it's got to be P&L. I could go into a dissertation as to why I think you can get rid of the double counting through the reclassification issue, but that's going to disagree with Scott, so I won't go there.
John, you probably have some greater experience than most of us in understanding putable shares that have been issued by entities. Do you think there should be a distinction between a putable share and a put option written independently, but requiring physical settlement?
I have thought about this in terms of the discussion here, and I think there is a distinction, because this is a contract with, if you like, the non-controlling interest, the third party, as opposed to what with the putable shares themselves, it's, are they, if you like, shareholders or are they not? And yes, that, you know, Laurent's saying it gives a silly answer. That was our argument in terms of the putable shares that it gave you. If you recall those liabilities and they, when company did well and they went up in value, you get a P&L hit as a debit, which gives a stupid answer, which is why the board agreed to have a look at it. But I think that this silly answer arguably is solvable, and I haven't thought it through as thoroughly as I probably should, Bob, but it has been going through my mind, and I think there is a distinction. I can think a bit further if you like, but at the moment that's where I've got to.
Not today. Laurence, your light has gone off. Does that mean that you no longer have a solution for us?
That twisting the allocation between comparing interest and NCI will not solve the issue, because when you have a change in fair value, say because the entity is going to be profitable, usually it's going to be profitable over years, and the fair value reflects the profits over several years, whereas you're going just in the allocation to get the profits of a year, not the profit of all future years. So that year when the fair value will increase, you will still have an expense that may not make sense and just reflect the fact that the entity, the sub, is going to generate profits in future years.
All right. You can carry on this interchange after the meeting. We don't need more problems. All right. Final comments, and then I'm going to ask you a question. Bernd?
I'm also in favor of P&L for various reasons. All has been discussed. But I think there is a distinction between ordinary puttable shares and this situation, which would be clear if in agenda paper 4B we would not debit NCI but equity, because upon exercising you would see that you would redeem the liability against cash, and then you have NCI against ordinary equity. So you have two journal entries, and if you have a normal redeemable share, you just have one journal entry, that's the liability and cash. So I think there is a distinction.
Okay. Peter, final comment?
I think it depends on, well, the answer depends on how we look at this transaction. I can understand that probably the majority says what we have here is a reclassification from equity to liability, and then I agree we are in 39 and the liability has to be measured through P&L. The other view that might be taken by the minority seems to be we have a liability, but it's not a reclassification. The liability is part of the consideration that has been paid in order to acquire the non-controlling interest. And if I look at that and look into 31 of 27 again, that might tell me that the fair value of the consideration paid for this NCI should be charged to equity. So it really depends on how you look at the transaction. Either it's a simple reclassification, then we are in 39, or the liability is part of the consideration to be paid in order to acquire the NCI. And then I think you can have some arguments showing it in equity.
All right. Do you know the criteria for our agenda decisions include one, which is that we expect that the committee will be able to reach a consensus on a timely basis. So I'm going to ask you the question as to whether or not you agree. It's question one on page 13 of agenda paper 4C. Who would object? Put this way. Who would object to the staff recommendation that changes in the carrying amount of a financial liability for an NCI put should be recognised in profit and loss in accordance with IAS 39? And that's putting aside how we initially recognise it. But if there is a liability, who objects to recognising changes in the carrying amounts of that liability through profit and loss? Can you please raise if you're... One... Two, three. Lawrence, you're invited to the committee to express your views. If you don't want to express the views, please don't wave your ring. Two people object. Okay? So the staff record, is that correct? John Lee and Tuck. Right. So then we proceed on the basis of measurement of the liability through profit and loss. Changes in the measurement of the liability through profit and loss. All right, David, I hope you're not going to be disappointed, but I rather thought we could have a change, unless you can give me a guarantee that we can finish paper 4D before the sun goes down tonight. We do have time allocated for you tomorrow morning as well.
I think that would probably be preferred. I do think
with some of the decisions we've taken today, that maybe clears the path for some of these subsequent issues, and maybe for some of the decisions we couldn't make today, it might ask us a separate, might change some of the staff recommendations around whether we should be addressing some of these issues in the scope of the proposed interpretation.
Okay. So if you'd like to reflect on what we've discussed so far this afternoon, and if you want to modify, as long as there's been something in the paper that addresses it, then we can look at that tomorrow morning. And that will be first item on the agenda at 9:30. Andrew?
Well, just to reiterate that, when I read these papers, I thought that there was a fair chance we might be able to agree on 4C and that we would have some difficulty in agreeing on some of the issues, and clearly that's been the case in 4D. So I would just encourage the staff to consider whether it's worth thinking of doing an interpretation just on 4C to get something sorted rather than getting nothing sorted, because it's too big a project if you look at all elements.
So, to paraphrase Scott's comments, any improvement would be desirable in this particular case. Okay. Now we go on to...